I'm here in Pavilion Gardens Cafe with Brian Mitchell for about the fourth or fifth time we've had a chat. And this isn't an interview, I've decided. I think this is going to be an attempt at least at well-intentioned life coaching. So my opening kind of life coachy statement, Brian, is you're not really going to the Edinburgh Fringe, are you?
Oh, I am. Oh, dear. Yes, we are. I mean, it's really Ross and Dave's decision more than mine and Joseph's. They were happy to do it. I think we toured it a couple of times, and I think they felt that it needed the little fillip of, you know, extra publicity that you get up in Edinburgh. Personally, I counselled against that, but we've got a good space, and it's the Assembly Festival, and I think there's a fair wind behind it, but you never know with Edinburgh. but there's good advanced press, so they may well have made the right decision. We'll see. I think they'll have fun there. I think it's a good show for fringe festivals.
So it's just last attempt at life coaching. So have I got this right? What you're hoping to get is the Japanese tourists that are going to be up there, love of 1970s professional wrestling.
Well, you never know. They might. The weird thing is, when we were taking the show around, we found, especially when we were Royal Touring, a lot of children turning up, even though we'd said this is not suitable for, you know, young kids. But a lot of children who couldn't possibly have any knowledge of Big Daddy and Giant Haystacks came along and loved the show, you know. So, you know, we were, or you always, you're kind of objective, really, in writing anything like this, is that it amuses and entertains and it illuminates those who know nothing about the subject as much as it does those who know it thoroughly. I think we've succeeded in that. So that's gratifying anyway.
And for those that don't know about the show, I mean, and we've talked about this before, this is a piece of writing and a piece of theatre that, though it plays out in terms of the history of professional wrestling, it's about a much bigger wrestling match, isn't it?
Yes, it is, really. It's about, you know, it's about the wrestling match between the North and the South of Britain. It's about the wrestling match between, you know, a kind of brash Thatcherism replacing a kind of older order. It's a wrestling match of American hegemony over Britain. It's a play about Britain, and the beautiful thing about Big Daddy and Giant Haystacks, and part, I think, subconsciously of their success was that they chose very much to become emblems of two strains of the British character. As I say, I'm not sure how conscious that was, but by the early 80s, during the Falklands War, Big Daddy's transformation to sort of John Bull, you know, to a 20th century, but John Bull was complete. He was wearing a tin hat and constantly seen in the Union Jack leotard or waistcoat, that was the figure he chose to personify, and sometimes did enter the ring as John Bull. And Haystacks is this more sort of we say in the play, kind of pagan, Celtic, wild, untamed, sort of blasted heath side of the character, it just seemed to be a nice springboard to. But the story, you can't help it if you follow the story. You know, you especially those key years, sort of 76 to 88, you can't help but tell the story of Britain. It's a particularly momentous time.
Now, you write often with Joseph Nixon, but I just want to focus on the man before me here, Brian Mitchell. Now, Brian Mitchell, Ornate Johnson's fabulous sketch comedy. Brian Mitchell, the Foundry Group, fabulous plays, The Magnificent Men, to name, you know, October Revolutions, all kinds of, you know, good theatre. How does Brian Mitchell, the sketch writer, you know, who wants to get a laugh, get on with Brian Mitchell, the full-bodied playwright?
So very, very well, actually. I think the sketch writer never really goes, because I've always wanted to sort of entertain people. The sketch writer was frustrated at just being a sketch writer, because, you know, it's good to tell big stories and to engage in other emotions. So I feel that the Brian Mitchell, the playwright, contains Brian Mitchell, the sketchwriter, and is a sort of bigger entity, really. You've seen with Seven Studies, you know, that obviously has a foot still in the kind of Ornette Johnson's kind of style, you know, the longish sketches, but they are plays, you know, there's something more going on, and I think that's what really engages me. It's what's always been the ambition as a writer, really. You know, I started off doing sketch writing because it's great fun, and I think we were good at it, but also because I think I foolishly believed one day somebody would turn around and say, you know, your sketches, the dialogue's great, why don't you write some plays for us? But that never happens. You actually have to make the choice yourself to go into what is really a completely different area, you know, totally different contacts, totally different people in the, you know, in the theatres, the television, or, you know, I suddenly found myself having to ditch all my press contacts that I'd had over the years, you know, people like Bruce Dessau and Malcolm Hay had been very supportive, but, you know, they don't cover theatre. So, you know, you're sort of suddenly in quite a lonely place to make that change, but I'm very glad I did.
But, you know, you guys have chosen to play, you know, a big signature venue at the Fringe, you know, playing at Assembly, and, you know, you've got actors like Dave Mountfield who are very good at playing for laughs, but for this to work, you need to capture the theatre audience. You don't want a bunch of drunken stand-up comedy fans coming in and saying, this isn't funny, do you?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it is a play first and foremost, and you know, and it ends quite tragically, really. I mean, there's a bit of an upbeat final resolution, but the story is essentially a tragedy in leotards. But that's one of the reasons why we have it at lunchtime slots. You know, if this is theatre, this is a play, and there are sort of fairly raucous elements to it, and there's the don't want to give away too much, but there's the wrestling match that you eventually do see, and there's a little bit of audience participation. Essentially, this is a tragic story, and an engrossing one. So I think the audience has, you know, come to expect a play rather than entirely knockabout sketches. I mean, it's definitely a play.
Since you first began your sort of journey as a writer, both you and Joseph Nixon, and you mentioned Seven Studies in Salesmanship, which is your latest kind of co-writing project. When I first met you, you weren't family men, and now you are. You know, I got a text from you saying, on my way, bloody kids. Has that changed you as writers, do you think, stepping into family life?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, you can't help it. Your focus changes in things that you find moving, when we were writing Big Daddy, one of the things that really moved us both was a kind of red thread running through the show was that they constantly, because of their popularity of children, were visiting dying children, we thought that this must have been a sort of tremendous emotional drain, emotionally draining for them, I don't think we'd have had the same attitude towards it had we not had children. You know, with the best will in the world, it really does, you know, change your view. And I think there are just different ways in which it kind of deepens or and enriches your sort of worldview, really.
And to name but a few, October Revolutions and Big Daddy versus Giant Haystack, Seven Studies in Salesmanship, many, many more. Is there a through line?
Yes, there is. I think, being entertaining, always to try to be entertaining, no matter how sort of serious the subject. Two, I think, always, you know, to tell a good story and to not give too much away to the audience, and let them do some work. And I think as well, you know, this is one of those things that I know colours what we write, but we can't help it. A kind of warmth towards, you know, we have this kind of sympathy for all the humans that we write about. You know, I don't really believe in villains. You know, I mean, of course there are villains, but there's always something richer going on, and I I think that colours it. And also, you know, some people might spot this or not, but all our characters live in a godless universe, really. There's no supernatural aid. There's nowhere they can turn to. You know, that's not something we would sort of screech about, you know, because you know, it's not something that obsesses me every day. But, you know, what you feel metaphysically about the world can't help but colour your writing. And I think that there is a red thread running through them all. And I think, as well, a real belief in the well-made play. You know, I mean, I feel that that's been... We've held out for that for a good 20, 25 years. There was a time, you'll remember, when people didn't even believe you should be doing words at all on stage, you know. The well-made play was a dirty phrase, if not word. Now, I mean, that's gone. I mean, Eightbourne is now hailed as a sort of genius virtually everywhere. You know, Rattigan's been completely exonerated. Yeah, and the well-made play is well and truly back, but... You know, it's a particularly good way of telling a story. I don't see any reason why it should have been so vilified as it was. But, you know, we've always believed in it and we feel that our time has come.
Coming back to Big Daddy now, on its way to Edinburgh. So when we first saw it a couple of years back, it was well received. But then, and this is the bit people don't see, there's you and Joseph again with the script and taking it further. So what's happened to the piece in its onward journey? How's it changed? How's it developed?
Well, we cut it down a little bit. Not very much. We cut about 7 minutes out the first night, which was in Brighton Fringe. We'd written it to be a little bit too long because the piece was so... There were so many things that could go wrong in it, so many strange decisions. We didn't know whether the crowd would accept, which they seemed to. But we felt we really had to put it in front of an audience before we could make any proper choice over those. We realised what worked and what didn't, made those cuts, and it's a tighter show. It's obviously, we've had to make more cuts because it's going to be in a 75-minute slot in Edinburgh now. The show normally would run at about an hour and 25, an hour and a half. But that show, which was at Buxton, that 75-minute show, that works very nicely as well. We were quite, you know, it's a different beast, but we're very pleased with it. In the way that I thought the Magnificent Men suffered from being cut down to that length, I think this one actually works rather nicely. But the main thing was, as I said earlier, because of children turning up against our wishes, we found that we had to make it a much more family-friendly show. I mean, you know, Dave and Ross simply did not... I mean, at first we took, you know, one of our sources, and you can't help it because it's a great source, was Simon Garfield's The Wrestling. And there's a lot of verbatim dialogue in it, and we... You know, and there's a lot of heavy swearing, and we lifted that, and we ran with it because that was obviously, you know, the tenor of their conversations. But we couldn't do that anymore. You know, David Moss didn't want to stand on stage in front of 7-year-olds in the front row, you know, using F's and even and F's and C's. So what we did was that we sort of reached back into the hinterland and remembered all the swearing that our parents did in the 70s, the stuff that they could get away with in front of kids, but which was bizarre. It was very odd. It really rooted it in the 70s and the 80s in a way that the full-on swearing simply didn't, because of course that's timeless. But you know, no one says phrases like bloody hellfire anymore. You know, that's gone. It's so bizarre. It was such a standard phrase, and it's gone. And so we found them. And we reintroduced them, and it really gives it a smack of the period, and it just makes it a much more family-friendly show. So that's a significant change. We've also sort of simplified some of the staging. There were problems with it in the old, you know, the old courtroom's not an ideal space for some show like that. But we have a gimmick with a sort of central. Kind of dress over a curtain and kind of back at the centre stage, which they use a great deal in the performance, and it's very handy. It makes for lots of quick changes, which of course they need. Those are the main ways in which it's changed, really. I think it's a more successful show because of it.
Final question, coming back into life coaching mode. When you're too old for this game, do you think you're going to want all these things to be surrounding you, or would you like to wave them goodbye?
I think I want them surrounding me. It's odd, this, you know. One of the reasons why I would, you know, kind of turned back on telly, although probably television turned its back on me, to be fair, but was I realised that there was very little that I'd done for radio or telly that I would be happy to show to my grandkids. What I'd want to show them was like the show that I'd done above a pub, or the you know, this particular play that only did, I don't know, 17 dates or whatever. That those were the things that I felt artistically proud of, and strangely, they can make more money as well. You know, television sort of dandles this hope of, you know, a big paycheck, which eventually you'll get, but you look back at all the hours you've spent getting it, and you realise you've been working for about £3 an hour, you know, I made that decision. I've got one life and I'm going to do what I believe.
So a pretty well-formed Brian Mitchell, still waving the flag for the well-formed play. Thanks very much.
Thank you.